Hello, welcome once again to Leto's Law. I'm Steve Leto. I went to law school in California, and when you're in law school, you read a lot of national cases, U.S. Supreme Court cases, and so on. But once in a while, you read cases from other places, and if there's a particular case that really explains something really well, they'll often use that as a teaching example. And when I was in law school, one of the cases I read from Michigan struck me as being very odd. But I've gotten a few requests lately to talk about this case, and I suspect the people who asked for it either went to law school or know a little bit more about the law, because it's an obscure case, but it actually explains a certain legal proposition fairly well. But I disagree with the case 100%. However, when I was in law school, I had to read it and had to understand it enough to where I could explain the concepts behind it. And this is one of those rare examples where I think the law is completely wrong. But it's a contract issue, and this goes back to the 1880s. But it's, you know, still considered to be good law. So the case is called Sherwood versus Walker. It's a Michigan case from 1887, and it involves the sale of a cow. I kid you not. The case was a Replevin case. Now, that's an archaic term we don't use anymore, but the suit was commenced in the local court. The plaintiff won the case. It got appealed to the Circuit Court of Wayne County. Again, the plaintiff won the case. The defendant brought it up to the Supreme Court, Michigan Supreme Court, and set out 25 assignments of error. And it's bizarre the way this case turned out, but I'll explain to you what's going on here. The defendants reside in Detroit, but have a business in Ontario and have a farm at Greenfield in Wayne County, upon which were some blooded cattle supposed to be barren as breeders. So as you might imagine, if you are in the cow business, cows are used in commerce a couple different ways. One is they can, if they're, you know, capable of doing this, they create milk. However, there are also cattle that are used to create meat, okay? And so if you have a cattle, female cattle that's capable of reproduction, okay, that's considered to be a different thing. I can't say different animal because it actually is an animal. A different thing than a cow that is considered to not be capable of breeding. And so the defendants are importers and breeders of Angus cattle, and the plaintiff is a banker living in Plymouth, Michigan. Now, the plaintiff called upon the defendants at Walkerville for the purchase of some of their stock, referring to the cattle, but he found none there that suited him. Meeting one of the defendants afterwards, he was informed that they had a few head upon their Greenfield farm. He was asked to go out and look at them, with the statement at the time they were probably barren and would not breed. Probably barren and would not breed. May 5th, 1886, plaintiff went out to Greenfield and saw the cattle. A few days thereafter, he called upon one of the defendants with the view of purchasing a cow known as Rose Second of Aberlone. I could be mispronouncing that, but I will not apologize for mispronouncing the name of a cow. After considerable talk, it was agreed that defendants would telephone Sherwood at his home in Plymouth in reference to the price. The second morning after this talk, he was called up by telephone. And they want to stress this newfangled thing in here called a telephone. So remember, this is 1887. And the terms of the sale were agreed upon. He was to pay 5.5 cents per pound live weight, 50 pounds shrinkage. These are all terms of art, irrelevant to the case. He was asked how he intended to take the cow home, and he replied that he might ship her from King's Cattle Yard. He requested defendants to confirm the sale in writing, which they did by sending him a letter that said, "We confirm sale to you of the cow, Rose Second of Aberlone, lot 56 of our catalog," and they give a price. And then he wrote back to them, the buyer did, and said, "You will deliver, please, at King's Cattle Yard, the cow, Rose, Second of Aberlone, lot 56 of the catalog. Send halter with the cow and have her weighed." And so on the 21st of the same month, the plaintiff went to defendant's farm at Greenfield and presented the order and letter to Graham, who informed him that defendants had instructed him to not deliver the cow. So they had a binding contract to buy and sell a cow. They both stood there and looked at the cow and said, "Yes, we both agree, you know, I'm selling you this cow." And the other guy goes, "I'm buying this cow." They agree on a price. Boom, that's a done deal. It's carved in stone, my friends. So what happened was They discovered that the cow was with child, or with calf, I guess. And the seller, realizing that now that the cow is worth a lot more money, has asked and decided to back out of the deal. And the buyer's like, no, we have a contract. The seller's, yeah, but we didn't think she could get pregnant again. So the defendants then introduced evidence tending to show that at the time of the alleged sale, you know, when Supreme Court justices are writing an opinion, they shouldn't be hinting that far in advance how they're going to rule. But at the time of the alleged sale, it was believed by both the plaintiff and the defendants that the cow was barren and would not breed. So she cost $850, and if she'd not been barren, would have been worth from $750 to $1,000. So it's a price range that $850 falls in the middle of. After the date of the letter and the order to Graham, the defendants were informed by Graham that in his judgment the cow was with calf, and therefore they instructed him to not deliver her to plaintiff. On the 20th of May, 1886, they telegraphed plaintiff what Graham thought about the cow being with calf and that consequently they would not sell her. The cow had a calf in the month of October. On the 19th of May, the plaintiff wrote Graham as follows and says, "Dear sir, I have bought Rose or Lucy from Mr. Walker and will be there for her Friday morning. Do not water her in the morning." But anyway, they go back and forth, okay, over this issue. And the thing boils down quite simply to, there's two parties to a contract for sale of goods. Now, a cow is not a typical good, but it is a identifiable, definable, discrete thing. There's a cow. They've even identified it by name, and apparently there's a catalog listing that described the cow. They all agree that the subject matter of the contract is the cow. They negotiate a price. They agree on the price, and all of this is reduced to writing. That is a binding contract in every court in the land. So here's what happened. They are arguing about whether the parties actually had a meeting of the minds, as they say, because it appears from the record that both parties supposed this cow was barren and would not breed. And she was sold by the pound for an insignificant sum as compared with her real value if a breeder. She was evidently sold and purchased on the relation of her value for beef, unless the plaintiff had learned of her true condition and concealed such knowledge from the defendants. There's no evidence of that at all. There's no evidence of that at all. The judge is just throwing in weird stuff here. Before the plaintiff secured the possession of the animal, the defendants learned that she was with calf and therefore of greater value and undertook to rescind the sale by refusing to deliver her. The question arises whether they had a right to do so. The circuit judge ruled that this fact did not avoid the sale and it made no difference. But the judge writing here says, "I am of the opinion that the court made a mistake. I know that this is a closed question. I am of the opinion the dividing line between the adjudicated cases is not easily discerned, but it must be considered as well settled that a party who has given an apparent consent to a contract of sale may refuse to execute it if the assent was founded or the contract made upon the mistake of a material fact, such as the subject matter of the sale, the price, or some collateral fact, materially inducing the agreement, and this can be done when the mistake is mutual." So what the court said here was, yes, you had a contract. Plaintiff and defendant agreed on the sale of the widget, okay? They agreed on which widget it was. They agreed on the price. They agreed on delivery terms, everything. They agreed on all of that. But the court's saying at a later date, when someone realizes that both the parties were mistaken in some fact about the goods, that the contract can be called off. And it's such a strange proposition to me in this setting in particular, because nature is not as predictable as we'd like to think it is. We've all heard of the stories of, you know, in the news of some woman in another country who gives birth at the age of 75, right? We've heard of those things. And of course, I suspect this wasn't the first time a farmer thought his cow was done with that kind of business. And suddenly, oh my gosh, the cow is with calf. How did that happen? Well, you don't actually need to explain to the farmer how it happened, okay? You could probably just say, you know, if you'd been out in the field watching when the romantic music was playing, you probably could have figured out what was going on there. So the point is that, yeah, the farmer made a mistake, and the buyer may have made a mistake also. But isn't that the kind of mistake that's baked into this equation all along? I mean, do they really not expect that that's a possibility? I mean, there's no proof that you'd ever have that, yes, up to this point, the cow can reproduce, and from this point forward, it can't. That never happens. So to suggest that this certainty could exist, can go back and affect a contract that's already been executed, is kind of crazy to me. And I would liken this to, let's suppose, I've talked before about these winged cars. That's a Dodge Charger Daytona. And that, of course, was based on a 69 Dodge Charger, just didn't have the nose cone and the wing and a couple other minor accoutrements. But the sister car, that's the Plymouth Superbird, which is based on the Roadrunner. Believe it or not, they would take a 70 Roadrunner, put a wing on a nose cone and a couple other accoutrements, and it would become a Superbird. Superbirds are worth much, much more money than Roadrunners are. But back in 1970, they had a hard time selling some of these cars, and some people thought they were ugly. So what some guys actually did, and this has been documented, that some guys actually pulled the nose cone and the wing off their car and made it back into a Roadrunner if they had a Superbird. So let's suppose I'm poking around the internet one day, and I find a guy who says, I've got a 70 Roadrunner for sale, 1970 Roadrunner. And I go out and I look at it, and it looks nice. I walk around it. Yeah, this thing's impressive. You know, I look up the prices. I find out what a price goes for that kind of a Roadrunner. And I offer the guy the money, and the guy goes, sure. And I pay him the money and gives me the title and the keys to the car, and I drive the car home. A couple of days later, one of my buddies comes by, and he somehow knows a bit about these things. And he goes, Steve, he goes, are you sure that's just a Roadrunner? And I go, what do you mean? And he said, well, let's pop the trunk. So we pop the trunk, and in the trunk, you can see where there used to be holes to support a wing. And then you go up and you look at the fenders, and you realize that there used to be little fender scoops over the fenders, but they're gone now. And we discover a couple other things about the car that indicate, yeah, this thing actually at one point in time was a Superbird that somebody detuned, basically, back to a Roadrunner. So what you bought was actually a Superbird. I don't think there's a court in this land that would actually say, you know, Mr. Leto, at this point, you got to give the car back because you were both mistaken. You both thought it was a Roadrunner. And I think it should be incumbent on somebody who owns something and they choose to sell it. It should be incumbent on them to figure out what it is if they're going to sell it. And so the guy, if in fact a guy sold me a Roadrunner not knowing it was a Superbird, whose fault is that? And the guy who buys the cow and the farmer goes, I thought she was barren. Whose fault is that? I guess another example, let's come up with some more examples here. I go to a rummage sale and I'm flipping through some old paintings and I find the painting looks nice. And the rummage sale proprietor goes, oh yeah, got a bunch of paintings donated someplace. And those are just junk paintings, like the kind that you find in like hotel rooms, and they're $5 a piece. I say, okay, I buy this thing for $5, believing it to be a hotel grade painting. Take it home, showing it to my friends. One of my friends looks at it and goes, yes, dude, that looks a lot like this strange artist from New York who used to paint these strange paintings. I'm not even gonna make up a name here, but let's just assume there's some crazy artist from New York who makes crazy paintings. So I take it someplace and they go, oh my gosh, you found one of the lost, you know, Wittgensteins. It's one of the lost ones. This thing right here is worth $1 million. According to this law and this interpretation of the law, theoretically, if the seller found out that I bought that painting and I had gotten more than I bargained for, they can have the painting back because it was a mistake. They didn't think it was a lost masterpiece. I bought it not knowing it was a lost masterpiece. But again, I still think that most people in this country recognize that that's part of what happens when you go out and you buy things like this, is you might luck out. So it's good to know two things about the case of Sherwood versus Walker, despite the fact that the theoretical point of the case is still considered good case law. is that the case was sent back down for trial, and at trial the plaintiffs won. The guy who bought the cow won. But it doesn't change the fact that the Supreme Court said, as a theoretical matter, the parties, if they made mutual mistake like this, if they made a mutual mistake like this, that you can unwind that deal. Now, I can tell you that the dissent, the judges who disagreed with this opinion, wrote a dissent, and it's lengthy, but I'm going to read you the most important part. The dissent: entirely agree with my brethren that the right to rescind occurs whenever the thing actually delivered or received is different in substance from the thing bargained for and intended to be sold. But if it be only a difference in some quality or accident, even though the misapprehension may have been the actuating motive of the parties making the contract, it will still remain binding. In this case, the cow sold was the one delivered. What might or might not happen to her after the sale formed no element in the contract. So again, the parties agreed, I want to buy this. I want to sell this. I'll pay you this much. I'll take this much. They're agreeing on everything. So when the plaintiff gets the cow and takes the cow back to his farm, the fact that the cow has a calf later is actually a fact that the parties weren't contemplating, because it's something that is going to happen in the future. Now, I know what you're going to say, but the cow was presumably pregnant. I guess it's kind of hard to tell on a cow when they're pregnant because they're kind of fat to begin with. Yes, I just called cows fat. But I agree with that. I agree with that. The parties, you have to look at the snapshot in time when they made the agreement. And I understand it's possible, maybe, where parties were completely mistaken, like where we're both looking at this thing, but somehow somebody delivers this thing, and later on we realize, oh, that's the mistake. They delivered the wrong thing. I mean, I guess that kind of mistake, but that would also get spotted immediately by the buyer. So here is, like I said, the case. They said it was mutual mistake, and both parties were mistaken about the subject matter of the contract. The contract can be rescinded. In theory, yes, but I suspect that now, even if this law is in the books, most people are going to look at most of these situations and go, you know something, while you owned it, you could have examined it better to find out what you were selling, and then you went to sell it, and risk of loss should fall on you if you didn't inspect it properly. But again, that's my opinion, because the law, as I told you, laid down in Sherwood versus Walker on mutual mistake and contract, is still considered to be a good legal theory. So that's Sherwood versus Walker, Michigan, 1887, or the case involving the cow, Rose of Abilene. Questions or comments, put them below. Otherwise, talk to you later. Bye-bye.